Welcome to the Racing Post Bloodstock Top Lot podcast, brought to you in association with Irish Thoroughbred Marketing. From the Cheltenham Festival to the Melbourne Cup, Irish Thoroughbreds will take you to the top. Irish Thoroughbred Marketing is your all-access pass to the world-leading Irish racing industry. Visit itm.ie to source your Irish champion. I'm Martin Stevens, and I'm here with Racing Post's Tom Turner. Hi, Tom. How are you?
Hi, Martin. Very well, thanks. How are you?
Yeah, not too bad. What's going on in Racing Post Bloodstock at the moment?
It's been an interesting few months. We've released the Progeny Tracker app, which has been very exciting. The response to that has been really good. A lot of positive feedback, which is really nice. That can be downloaded on the App Store on iOS and on the Google Play Store on Android. And then we've also released, obviously, Good Morning Bloodstock, which you're writing for us on every weekday morning, which you probably are too modest to say, but we've had a lot of compliments on it, which is really nice.
Yeah, and some very thought-provoking letters. It's I like to think of it as an open resource everyone can take part in, and some people have been sending in some really good ideas for debates and trends in the bloodstock industry, so that's very enjoyable and going well.
Yeah, it seems to be going well, which is nice. Anyone who is listening to this and doesn't know what Good Morning Bloodstock is, you can sign up to that by going to racingpost.com/goodmorningbloodstock, and that will come through to you every weekday morning at 7 a.m.
Great. So our guest this time on the podcast is David Redvers, owner and manager of Tween Hill Stud in Gloucestershire, and racing manager to Sheikh Fahad Al Thani. Hello, David. How are you?
Good morning. I'm very well. How are you?
Yes, not too bad. Let's crack straight on, as I know you'll be busy preparing for the sales this week and with the normal everyday business at Tween Hills. So you're represented by no fewer than 3 debut yearling sires this year, and all eyes will, of course, be especially on the ill-fated Roaring Lion's sole crop. David, he was such a charismatic champion and obviously a hugely important horse for Qatar Racing and Tween Hills. Thinking back to when you clapped eyes on him at Keeneland 5 years ago, what were your first impressions of him?
It's a good question. I mean, basically, we'd been underbidder on Hawkbill when he went through the sales a couple of years before. And I had then become very obvious to me that Kitten's Joy was a pretty serious stallion. And we were always looking for the turf angle when you go out to Kentucky. And I'd said to Hannah Wall, my assistant, and Peter Mullaney, both of whom had been on my sort of buying team for over a decade, that I would definitely be very keen to see any Kitten's Joy yearlings that looked athletic, regardless of their conformation faults, because he's clearly a very good stallion, and we never seem to bid on any of them because they tend to be a bit crooked. Mm. Anyway, he doesn't really get a sales horse. Hannah came up to me quite excited and said, I've found one. There's a Kitten's Joy at Taylor Made, if you can bear to fight through the crowds of people down there. He's a grey horse, you need to see him because he's just fantastically athletic and a really light mover, which is a sort of one of the trademark things we look for. And as soon as I saw him, it was absolutely obvious to me that we had to buy the horse. The difficulty was, at the time, Sheikh Fahad had decided he didn't want any grey horses because he'd had a couple of ungenuine ones. And so we had to convince him that he needed to buy this one. Luckily, Roaring Lion was a good iron. At that stage, he was a very dark iron grey. And that got us away with it. But it was one of those moments. We have a few where you see a horse and it just smacks you straight between the eyes, and it seemed completely obvious to us, but it, thank God, didn't seem completely obvious to anybody else. And I'm pretty sure that the underbidder was the vendor. Bought him for $160,000.
Well, it's quite funny that there were worries about him or a grey horse being perhaps ungenuine, because Roaring Lion had a wonderful racing career, of course, and actually an unusually busy 3-year-old campaign. What do you think his key qualities were as a racehorse?
That he was incredibly genuine. And that he had a searing turn of foot. He was a bit slow to get off the blocks as a 3-year-old. I mean, as a 2-year-old, he finished the season very well. Just Greenness really beat him in the Racing Post Trophy. Now Greenness and Saxon Warrior. Then as a three-year-old, he was finding things so easy. And because in Newmarket we'd had that horrifically wet and cold spring, he'd never been able to get on the grass. So, you know, when he first turned up in the Craven, I remember John Gos, first of all, looking and waddle around the paddock, and he was quite clearly a load of puppy fat still to shed. John Gosden said to me, "We will laugh at the end of the season how we ever managed to get him beat today," which gave me a little bit more confidence, but also made it pretty obvious he didn't expect him to win. Not least because Massar came into the paddock looking like a sort of finely tuned athlete who'd been on his summer holidays and or been in a summer training camp, which of course he had. Mm-hmm. The thing that you know, back to your question, that really excited me about him as a racehorse was the fact that he had the will to win. You can't, it's totally an undeniable factor about the horses that once he realized when the penny dropped what he was supposed to do, from the eclipse on, he just, nothing was going to beat him. And the manner in which he stuck his neck out and quickened and stretched was something to behold.
It was that Judmont International, wasn't it, where I think everyone just suddenly sat up and took notice and thought, God, this is a brilliant horse.
Yeah, I mean, certainly speaking personally, it was more that, I mean, we were in Japan when he won the Eclipse, so I was watching, you know, only for the first few times I ever saw it on Peter Maloney's iPad. But the Judmont was a phenomenal performance. That was the performance that crowned him as world champion. Mm. But for me, there was no better performance than his performance in Ireland, where, you know, everything, yeah, it was played out quite brilliantly by the Ballydoyle team to make it as difficult for him as possible. And Saxon Warrior got first run on him. But he was in the paddock beforehand, he exuded this confidence. And I mean, he looked like he was fully prepared to eat whatever got in his way. And during the race, he was never going to get beat. I've said before, we've never had a better day on the race course than Champions Day, but that wasn't the manner of his victory. It was the fact that he won it all, because he was running back down over a mile and on heavy ground that he really did not enjoy at all. Mm-hmm. And it was the fact that we were there in, you know, Sheik Fahd and his brothers and myself in the Royal Box with Her Majesty. And, you know, the whole thing was just incredible. But yeah, the most, for me, his most exciting and impressive victory was in the Irish Champion Stakes. And it was, all the photographs I have scattered around my office, it's a bit Roy Lyon heavy in my office when it comes to works of art and photograph. his neck stuck out as he went past Saxon Warrior. That's why we do this. That's why from the age of 18, I've got up in the morning and jumped out of bed and tried to find the next one, because that's, you just dream about having a champion. And it felt like a long time in coming.
And he was I came to see him at Tween Hills early in 2019 a few times, and it sounds a bit of a naff word to call him charismatic, but he really was, wasn't he, the way he showed himself and just his look as well, because he was dapple by then, and there was something actually quite special about him, wasn't there?
Yeah, you'll get me all teary if you're not careful. We had a pretty strong relationship. And everybody did really with him. Everybody adored him. He lived, as you recall, sort of opposite my kitchen window. And, I would walk him every morning. He was just such a character. I mean, he was a complete piss taker. He'd stick his tongue out at you. And I mean, he was just a dude, a complete dude. And one of those few horses that you come across in your lifetime where you actually, you know, they're that bit more intelligent than the majority of the kind. And I am lucky to have a couple like him, but he was just very special.
So he duly covered a glittering book of mares in early 2019. Sadly, he lost his life in the summer when he went to New Zealand. We won't dwell on that. And if it's not too sad to talk about, could you put into words sort of the psychological impact that had on you, the people at Tween Hills and Sheikh Fahad? Because it's so, you know, it was so sudden and so sad, obviously. Did it sort of make you think, you know, God, what we're doing? Or, you know, did it must have stopped you in your tracks.
I confess that it did, actually. It absolutely floored us, because one, he was sort of part of the family. Two, you know, I've spent I don't own a stock or a share in you know, anything other than a four-legged hairy creature. Everything I've ever saved, I've put into Tween Hills. And when it was obvious that we had him and Zoustar coming, you know, we spent another £1 million plus upgrading the facilities at Tween Hills, so that it was worthy of a world champion and a horse that Sheikh Fahd had so generously entrusted us with. So we went to town. Suddenly, I was staring down the barrel of you know, this huge investment that had gone into the farm, for one specific horse, and so there was the financial implication, which scared me rigid. Then on top of that, there was the sort of the fact that you felt the wind completely taken out of your sails, because, you know, the next 5 years future of your business was going to revolve around Roaring Lion, and you know, the fact that there'd been this sort of financial security aspect to it sort of disappeared was not great. But it was more than that, because it was the horse himself, and the fact that we'd taken so long to find a genuine world champion who had captured the imagination of the public like he had, and then to have that bright light suddenly snuffed out did leave a big empty, you know. And probably, you know, there's friends of mine who said, right, you've said enough about Roaring Lion, I'll move on. And there was definitely an element of, you know, you could get quite maudlin. You know, at the end of the day, he's left us with a fabulous crop of yearlings. Please God, one of them in our ownership will end up being a Dubawi to Dubai, you know, for Dubai Millennium type, you know, outcome. But it is what it is. And, you know, we all know when you live and work with livestock, that from livestock come dead stock, and it's you know, the risk we all take. And there have been a few times where I've been properly emotional over losing a horse, you know, from the favourite kid's pony to Lady Rebecca to my brilliant hunter and Roaring Lion. And you feel a bit like you've lost a family member, and you know, as I think Ruby Walsh said, you know, you leave those animals outside the kitchen door. Some of them somehow sneak in. And he was one of those.
So we have that soul crop of Roaring Lion cubs, as we like to call them. Speaking objectively as you possibly can, what's your view in them? Did he stamp his stock, if that is a thing, and if it's a positive thing indeed? What do you think of them?
Well, you can't miss the fact they are what they are. They've got his head, they've got his action. He was, you know, for some, I suspect he wasn't sort of quite man enough at the yearling stage, particularly in Book One of Keeneland, where he, you know, was up against whopping great tappets and whatever. But he is. He improved and grew and strengthened, and basically every day of his life he got bigger and stronger, pretty much up to the day he died. You know, hence John Gosden was able to run him quite so regularly, and every time he ran, he came back and he put on 5 kilos. It just didn't make any sense. But his stock appeared very similar. You know, there was a stage as foals where, you know, you just go, my God, I can't believe we've lost this horse, they're just too good. And then come June this summer, I thought a few of them just looked a bit weaker than I'd have liked. I was a bit disappointed that they didn't have a bit more Gaskin, and then now they're really coming out the other side and strengthening up again, and you know, there's we bought an unbelievably impressive physical by him at Arcana at a Sian Arch for $300,000. I mean, he was probably a stronger, bigger version of the horse at the same stage. But you just, you know, the head and the action just seems to be, and to a large degree, the colour as well is there, and you can't miss them.
Yeah. Do you have a rough idea of how many Roaring Lion, Sheikh Fahad, or Qatar Racing will race itself next year?
Well, we've got 30 odd at the moment going into training, and we may buy one or two more. We're either going to have a phenomenal year on the racetrack in the next two seasons, or we're going to have an absolute horror show. Because Sheikh Fahad and his brothers have absolutely committed to sort of, you know, keeping and racing the ones that we've bred. And that's brilliant. And, you know, from a personal perspective, it's been the most fabulous journey. It'd be fascinating to see how they work out. But, you know, to have so many of them around you, lots with his silly temperament as well, is quite fun.
Well, 30 odd gives you a decent chance. If he's a good sire, it gives you a decent chance of having a very good horse by him and continuing the line, doesn't it? So that's quite positive, really.
Yeah, and the early signs are good. You know, Tim Rusbridge, who does the vast majority of our breaking and broken Roaring Lion, he smiles every time you send him another one. He really enjoys working with them, and they're so willing. My word of the day, willing. That's what they are.
Yeah. Now, moving on to Zoustar, who is possibly the best young sire in Australia, who shuttled to Tween Hills for the first time 2 or 3 years ago, and you now have his first yearling selling up here as well. Can you just remind us of how Qatar Racing became involved with him? And I think the really interesting thing with him is, can you explain why the decision was made not to shuttle him from Australia at the outset of his stalling career?
I've shown, you know, I was really interested in the horse prior to him running in the Coolmore, but you know, it was probably a bridge too far, a bit too different for Sheikh Fahad to really embrace the idea. And then when we went to Flemington and saw him win the Coolmore, then things changed. Sheikh Fahad was there. He was really impressed by his victory. And we went and saw him the next day. And he just blew us away. As a physical, he's just different. He's I wouldn't say a different breed or species, but you know what I mean? He just looks different. He's got such an enormous hip, such a huge jaw, wonderful head. I mean, he's got muscles where I didn't know you had muscles. And he's a fantastic physical with a brilliant mind. So we bought into him extremely expensively, I have to say, though now it's one of the deals of the century. And we brought him up to run him in the Diamond Jubilee. And unfortunately, at Charlie Hills very generously allowed Chris Waller to have the horse in training there, gave him a few stables. While he was preparing for Ascot, he bloody got a knock, and we couldn't run him. So we paraded him at the London sale, and everyone swooned all over him. And then we took him back home and retired him stud down there. But the feeling I got was that if we brought him back and retired him and reverse shuttled him at that stage, we wouldn't have enough traction. If he'd run at Ascot and won, that would have been a completely different story, obviously. But because he never even got to run, it was always going to be an uphill battle. So we thought that the best thing for the horse was to allow him to either shine or fail in Australia. And if he shone, then we'd bring him up and, you know, we'd be able to stand him, because the investment was so significant in him. To shuttle him and stand him at $10,000 wasn't going to make any sense. The risk versus reward didn't add up. Mm. Once he'd established that he was a successful horse, then it made sense. And although he stands at a third or whatever what he stands for in Australia here, you know, we at least were guaranteed good support, and we could support him ourselves with confidence. And that's, you know, real. The biggest challenge of standing stallions is getting the balance right between supporting them wholeheartedly and completely mucking up your broodmare band. Mm. If you know, if you have a couple of dud stallions on the trot, you kind of completely screwed up your broodmare. Yeah. So I didn't want to get him up here without knowing that it was going to work. Once it became obvious to us that it was going to work and work spectacularly well, it's been the easiest thing in the world, piling all our best mares into him. And you know, you started that segment by going one of the best young stallions in Australia. I would counter that by saying I believe he's one of the best young stallions in the world today, and I believe he's about to prove it in pretty sensational fashion. And it's, you know, we've got some unbelievable horses here going into training by him. We're going to be looking at every one at sales, and I'm very confident that you know, he represents a bit of an open goal for breeders and yearling buyers.
Yeah, I mean, he was, as you say, he's one of the best young sires in the world. I agree wholeheartedly. Now, not being negative at all, but sometimes, as we've seen over the years, shuttle stallions don't have the same success in both hemispheres, and sometimes there seems to be no rhyme or reason to it. Is there anything you can glean from Zoustar's pedigree or confirmation or racing record that makes you think that, you know, Zoustar will do it in both hemispheres, like an Exceed and Excel or one of those other ones who do it in both hemispheres?
Well, I'd flip that on its head and say to you, give me examples of stallions of his caliber in Australia that haven't done it here.
Well, the famous one was Reduced Choice, who went to France for a couple of years. And I know there's arguments about it might have been the type of mare he was sent.
I mean, you've given an excellent example. and you've also given the answer as to why, in my opinion. You know, you wouldn't find an Australian buyer who would buy a Reduced Choice out of a middle distance mare. Mm. You know, it doesn't work out down there. He's also getting to the end of his career at that stage. For, you know, our view, and we have advised where we possibly can all those breeders that were keen to use Zoustar, is that if you look at the tables down in Australia and New Zealand for sprinter sires and miler sires, he's right at the top of both. As soon as you go into middle distance, you have to go down to about 43rd till you find him.
Yeah.
We're not trying to reinvent the wheel here. We are absolutely not piling all our slow mares into him in the hope that we can speed them up. What we've done is we've sent him all of our speed mares.
Yeah.
And we've encouraged others to breed along the same lines. Now, I'm not saying, you know, don't buy one out of a middle distance mare, but our experience is that if you buy one out of a precocious or speed mare or a miler, you're in the sort of Kingman Dubawi territory rather than the lower end of the scale.
And talking of precocity and speed, you've made quite a statement with your Wesley Ward project. Can you explain what's going on there?
Well, that was entirely Sheikh Fahd's idea, and I have to say it made me smile at the time. He had lunch with Wesley in Newmarket and the weekend before Royal Ascot. We'd bought a share in Nakatomi. He was running in one of the two-year-old races. Mm-hmm. And he decided he wanted to come and see the Zoustar, Sheikh Fahd had told him. So Sheikh Fahd flew him up here. We had a very jolly lunch, and we went round and looked at all of the Zoustar yearlings on the farm. And it was a fascinating insight into the way the great man works, because he didn't want to see any pedigrees. He didn't really want to see them walk. He just wanted to stand up and look at each of them. And he was allowed to pick the three that he thought would suit him best. And he picked the Zoustar colt out of Windfire, who was placed in the Norfolk for us. He picked the filly out of Lightning Quick, who was a Group 3 winner, winning daughter of Frankel and Lightning Pearl, who won the Tubing Masters. And he bought the filly out of the Flames, who was a showcasing filly that I bought at the Breeze Up sales that came third in the Queen Mary. And I have to say, he pretty much got the ones I would have, you know, as potential Royal Ascot horses that I would have picked just by looking at them stood up, which was quite interesting. He obviously has a, you know, there's a picture in his head of what they need to be. And luckily these three really appealed to him.
Yeah, good. And we mustn't forget the third Tween Hills stallion, who's represented by his first yearlings that this year, and that's Lightning Spear, Group 1 winning son of Pivotal with a very good pedigree. How's he getting along?
Well, he's the most charming horse. He's he was a brilliant racehorse, absolutely genuine, hard as iron. But sadly he suffered initially from fertility issues, fairly significant ones, which meant that his first book was rather depleted. Because once you have a stallion who's not stocking them as regularly as you want, you know, word gets out very quickly. And well, to be fair, you have to you tell your clients this is the case, and then the choice of shifting if they want to. So his excellent book of over 110 or 20 mares suddenly turned into a book of 40. Without giving into too much nitty gritty detail, he was producing too much gel as part of the problem, which was meaning that a lot of mares were coming back dirty and inflamed. Right. So we just learned how to handle that, and we managed to get his fertility figures up to really quite respectable level now. But it does mean that although he's got some really smart stock, there's not a lot of them. So he's always going to be fighting an uphill battle in much the same way, I suspect, as horses like Far as well. So he's having a lovely retirement with a few wives rather than working his socks off like the others.
Yeah. And what are your thoughts generally on the yearling market this year? Because it seems very strong, and how do you think COVID has played into that?
I think it's absolutely bizarre. I America incredibly strong, Australia incredibly strong, all makes perfect sense. Loads of prize money. People look at racehorse ownership in a different way than they do in the UK. Mm. There are buyers five deep in book five at Keeneland, because you know they get a horse to run in a maiden and it's running for $135,000, which means that they can see light at the end of the tunnel before they go into the tunnel. Whereas we go into the tunnel, there's not much light unless you manage to find, you know, a truly exceptional beast. The market so far here has been as you would have hoped it would be, but you know the next 3 weeks are going to be absolutely fascinating. You know, I'm not privy to the Mattoom family's buying plans, but it seems pretty obvious to all of us that Shadwell are downsizing significantly. In fact, they've said as much themselves. So you know, that's 8.5 million really come out of the Tassel's October sale that was spent there last year. For the first time, certainly in my professional living memory, there was no Mattoom involvement at all at Keeneland. I think 1982, they told me, was the last time they hadn't bought a horse. And yet Keeneland was, I mean, phenomenal trade because the very simple reason that there's great prize money and a huge depth of the buyer's market, buyer's bench. But what happens here? I've been telling my clients and winding up Shakefire that this is the year to be buying, because I feel that there's, you know, if they don't show up, there has to be a hole in the market. That said, the Americans appear to be turning up in their droves because we produce such a good product and their turf racing is becoming so much more valuable. So it'll be fascinating. It'll be fascinating. I'm not going there with any degree of confidence, but I'm going there with everything crossed.
Yeah. I'll turn you over to Tom now, who's got some questions about some of the other stallions on the Tween Hills roster.
Yeah, I was going to ask about Kamiko after his brilliant career. Firstly, how's he getting on with his new career?
He loves it. Thinks it's a great laugh. he's such a cool horse. He and Roy Lyon share that sort of impish character. He's He was incredibly fertile. He covered a full book in his first crop. We've chosen not to shuttle him for some obvious reasons, and it's really a, you know, it's a joy having him around the place. But the only thing I sort of jokingly spoke to Andrew Balding, well, only sort of jokingly spoke to Andrew Balding about maybe we should try and win the Sussex Stakes and the Jacques Le Marwa and the QE2 this year, because he's doing nothing other than dossing around in his paddock. And the horse looks absolutely magnificent, and like he's now mature, whereas he still looks a bit of a baby when he came to stud last autumn.
So he and Roaring Lion were both by Kitten's Joy, obviously, and both bought from Keeneland. Were there any similarities between the two as yearlings that you spotted?
They were the two best Kitten's Joys in the sales, in our opinion. Mm-hmm. That really was what we were looking for. We wanted the best bred, the best physicals. Cameco's very correct indeed. Roaring Lion was a bit towed in, as so many of them can be, but nothing, you know, not to any degree, but they both have the major similarities. They're both so light on their feet and such beautiful movers, and have got that lovely head and outlook.
Martin's actually been mentioning another of the Tween Hills roster on the Good Morning Bloodstock emails recently, which is Havana Gold. He's obviously had the Windsor Castle winner this year and placed horses in the Malcolm, Millreef and National Stakes. What's your view of his career so far at stud?
Well, he's a really fascinating insight into how difficult it is to make a stallion work at the commercial end of the market. You know, we stood him, I think, for 8.5, then 15, then down to 7.5 or whatever. You know, his fees gone all around the place because of everybody wanted to use him in his first crop. It was then very difficult to get mares to him in years 2, 3, and 4. When he was champion first season, so everybody wanted to use him, and he covered, I think, 183 mares at 15 grand a pop, with not a single discount given. And then when we were waiting for those to turn up and run, you know, it was hard work. Now that they've turned up and run this year, people are reminded by just what a good stallion he is, and that it wasn't a fluke first time round. And now I think he's established, properly established, and he's established himself with a nice commercial rate as a stallion that will get you a really good two-year-old and a winner and they train on, and he's a sprinter mile stallion ideally, though he can get middle distance horses. But you know, he comes at a time where there's some really, really, you know, British breedings in very good state. We've got some very good young stallions, Whitsbury Manor, Overbury, the National Stud, that, you know, we've all, and between us, we've all got some proper young stallions. You know, we'll see, we may well see our dad, you know, achieve another great goal today, and I'm thrilled for my neighbour Simon Sweeting, who's one of my oldest friends, that he's got a you know, proper horse from a relatively inexpensive base. So it's a very competitive market. We weren't helped this year by COVID, and all my Irish friends will laugh at me saying we weren't helped particularly by Brexit and the difficulties that came about and the movement to horses. So, you know, it's a really competitive game, and if we're not getting a lot of Irish mares coming across, then it makes it more so. But, you know, these things are all, it's a nice problem to have, in so much as we've got decent stallions and we can be justifiably proud of.
Can I just interject there, David? I have a question for you there to do with Havana Gold and that roller coaster he's been on. Do you think there's anything that stallion owners could do to do away with that roller coaster? A bit like, I'm thinking like the Spendthrift Share the Upside program in America, less so maybe the Darley Club, because the stallions in that weren't quite the best stallions that could have been in a program like that. Would you ever consider anything like that?
Yes, and we all those commercial horses here, we sell breeding rights or shares in, you know, people want them. We haven't gone down the route of, you know, a big marketing exercise based around one of those programs, and maybe we should, and maybe it's something I should give some thought to. You know, the stallions that have got a better chance of working are the stallions that are syndicated properly, and get a lot of support. part of the problem with that is that, you know, that's very easy to do if you're going out and buying an expensive horse off the racetrack, because you need to raise the finance to do it, and so it fits your, you know, it fits that model. If you're racing a horse that you, you know, bought as a yearling for 90 grand, for example, which was the case with Cameco, and he's suddenly worth a lot of money, it's difficult to maybe find the right value, the right level, give up equity in him. You know, these are all, you know, these are all things that mature in time, and you know, we'll work it out eventually, I'm sure. But the, you know, I'm delighted for the National Stud, for example. Their time test deal seems to be working out quite nicely. They've had a lot of support with the through syndicating the horse, and that guaranteed even better numbers in years 2 and 3. So, you know, I'm absolutely awake to how it works. And it's just a case of finding the right horse. And, you know, we should probably have sold more shares in Havana Gold. Also, that there's a slight change in dynamics over selling shares and breeding rights. Breeding rights were all the go at one point. Mm. And got a bit tired of them and wanted to go to the traditional share level. But they having bought breeding rights for a price, they then seem to want a traditional share, but at a breeding right price. And, you know, so it's getting breeders to invest and be part of the journey, but at a, you know, in a deal that works for everyone.
Yeah, on a fair basis. I get that. Tom, sorry, I'll hand back to you.
Thanks. I was going to ask one question, just winding the clock back a little bit and actually switching codes as well. If we go back to, I think it's 1993, you bought a horse for 400 guineas that ended up winning 7 times at Cheltenham and 3 times in successive years in the Cleve Hurdle. Can you just give us a little bit of background about Lady Rebecca?
Yeah, we've got the Lady Rebecca yard here, and she's buried beside the stallion paddocks, and her picture adorns all the walls here as well. She was the one that sort of really helped get us established. My mother very generously, when I decided I wanted to come home and turn Tween Hills into a stud, she was very excited by that, because she was the reason I was into horses in the first place, and thought it was a great idea. And that, you know, money was very tight, and when I said I wanted to go and buy a couple of horses, she you know, a small amount of money was put to one side. I spent 1,500 of it on a mare that turned into Otis Rose that we raced with Matt Shepherd, who won the mare's final at Newbury, and a nice big handicap at Sandown. And then I was left with 500 quid, which when I was up at that time, I was helping Mark Johnson buy his yearlings. And I was at Doncaster November National Hunt sale, and this filly walked past me in the parade ring, and I think I said to Dick Saunders at the time, shows how many years ago it was, crikey, if you saw a yearling walk like that, Mark Johnson would love that. That looks like it should have been at Tattersall's, not here, as a, you know, the October yearling sales. Anyway, we followed it in, and it had been offered and sold the day before, but it had been returned as a box walker. I think she'd made 2,100 the day before. She was returned as a box walker, put that through the ring by Needwood Stud. And I bought her for one bid at 400 quid, 400 guineas. And I remember, you know, the excitement of realizing that I'd bought something so cheaply that looked so athletic. And we raised a re-syndicated sent her initially to Simon Christian, who was training at Kinnersley. And then he ran her once, and she was placed in a bumper, came second. And then he retired from training, and we moved her to my great mate, Venetia Williams, who I was helping buy a few horses for. And we raced her to huge, you know, to huge effect. She was just, I mean, I watched all the videos again when we moved house about 5 years ago, because I found a box of them. Just what a superstar she was, and how lucky we were to have her. But then you have there's that wonderful moment where she, I can't remember whether it was Le Coudre or Barton or one of those horses, she went sailing past at the last in the Cleve Hurdle, and Simon Holt gave that fantastic commentary, here's 400 guineas, making 240,000 guineas. I think he at the time had been the most expensive horse in training, National Hunt horse in training, sold at public auction. She'd probably been the cheapest for quite a while. And it was she, like Roaring Lion, captured the public's imagination, had her own fan club because of that wonderful Cinderella story. And from our point of view, nobody had heard of Tween Hills before. Nobody had the first idea who we were, and suddenly, she got our name out there, and people started asking and wondering who this clown was who was racing. we had a great syndicate made up of Bob Clark and the Kinnersley Optimists, who were all lads from the pub in Kinnersley, the Royal Oak, and they were just so enthusiastic, and they'd all put in their 1500 quid or whatever it was, which was big money for a lot of them. And so the journey was even more special because it was shared with a lot of proper hardworking people who just had that same passion for the National Hunt racing. Mm-hmm. So she very much shaped my view of the industry, and the only thing is she's been like a taxation on weakness keeping her as a broodmare, because like a lot of grade one winners under National Hunt rules, she actually wasn't that good a broodmare, although she did produce one stakes horse. But her daughters all now look like they're going to be very good broodmares, and we're lucky that we've still got a couple of them. So having thrown money at her for the last however many years, she tragically died about 4 or 5 years ago. We've got a few daughters, and we were very lucky in that we sold the Blue Brazil colt out of her last foal, Mary Eleanor, at Doncaster yearling sale the other day, the National Hunt yearling sale, that was sort of put on later as a result of the of COVID stopping the November sale. And we topped the sale, made 42 grand, so that was, or 45, 42, I can't remember. Anyway, made plenty of money, and that was the first proper result we've had with one of her daughters.
God, that's great. So the legacy still lives on from that 400 guineas.
It does. And Mary Eleanor, funnily enough, her last, who's named after my great grandmother, was her last foal, and the most like her as a physical type and character. So we were always going to keep her. And I've got a lovely Cape Tara 2-year-old out of her that will be going into training, something that my mother can and wife and children can enjoy over the coming years.
Lovely.
That makes me think, David, when we're talking about the journey from Lady Rebecca to Roaring Lion and Zoostar. Sometimes when I look through sale returns and I see some of the horses you sign for and some of the horses you see that you buy privately, I sometimes get the impression that you still enjoy doing some of that. I won't call it wheeler dealing because that sounds slightly insulting, but so looking for clever little projects towards the middle or the lower end of the market, even though you're buying blue-blooded top lots at Book One as well these days. Is that fair to say? Are you always alive and aware to a nice little project?
Oh, definitely. The one thing that Lady Rebecca taught us is that, Group One, Grade One winners come in all sorts of sizes and shapes. And, everybody loves to buy the big, shiny, Galileo colt, full heart, three-quarters brother to a Derby winner. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. More often than not, it doesn't. For big money, but if you're lucky enough to have a client who's prepared to be that brave, foolhardy, there's nothing gives us more fun or pleasure than buying a cheapie that just ticks the boxes and works for you, has a message for you when you see them. And I buy quite a few little fillies still. Not always in my name, but I'll take legs and things that I really love the look of that don't fit our buying program, for Qatar or Tween Hills, but that look like a proper racy thing. Yeah. We've got a few of those scattered around, and some of them come really good, and some of them don't.
No, quite. Well, on that note, I'll thank you for your time, David. You've been very generous in giving us some fascinating insights into the Tween Hills horses and the wider bloodstock business. And I wish you good luck at the yearling sales and the breeding stock sales ahead.
Well, thank you, Martin. Thank you, Tom. And thank you for your patience. Let's hope we can see you at the sales and find another one.
Absolutely. Right, we'll be back with another Racing Post Bloodstock Top Lots podcast sponsored by Irish Thoroughbred Marketing in a few weeks.